Later this fall will be the official 50th anniversary of the premiere of one of the great sitcoms in television history, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. And to talk more about that, we are joined again this afternoon. I think it's the third time she's been on the program with us, by author and television critic Jennifer Cation Armstrong. Jennifer, thanks so much for coming back on with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Well, I want to talk about Mary Tyler Moore with the 50th anniversary coming up. And people may be surprised to realize that after the success of the Dick Van Dyke Show, she went into a bit of a professional slump. And in many ways, it was Dick Van Dyke who pulled her out of that by having her on his special, Dick Van Dyke and the Other Woman.
Yes, that is very true. She had done, you know, she had done kind of like a contract thing with a studio, that a movie studio that didn't work out, and the series of kind of flops. She was involved in a notorious flop on Broadway, a musical version of Breakfast at Tiffany's, and just was not quite going the way anyone thought it would go right for her after she had had this incredible role on the Dick Van Dyke Show. And yeah, he invited her. He was doing one of those variety specials that they used to do, and invited her to come on that. And, you know, even put her in the title to some extent, right? Dick Van Dyke and the Other Woman was a joke about how people always sort of like thought he was married to her in real life, and would give his wife dirty looks. and I watched the special as part of my research for my book, and it really makes sense that she got a show out of it, because she's just delightful. You know, he really sort of let her shine and let her have a good half of the show. And, you know, she did sing and dance and all of that stuff too. So it really let her use all of her talents, and everybody just, you know, was bowled over and reminded that she should be on television all the time. So that is how we got the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
So how did Mary and her husband Grant Tinker get together with James L. Brooks and Alan Burns, who ended up being the producers?
Jim and Alan had been working on a show called Room 222, which was not as it's not as remembered now as the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but was really well respected and well reviewed at the time. And Grant Tinker loved it, and he loved their work on it, and really wanted to bring them in because he thought, rightly, I think, that these guys had kind of a vision that was going to spin television forward. He loved that they were very interested in sort of realism, you know, grounding their characters in realism, making them feel fully realized, and also having them face, you know, modern real issues and problems, instead of just kind of like, we were coming out of the 60s when you had these shows like I Dream of Jeannie and Gilligan's Island and the Beverly Hillbillies. They were almost fantasy. I mean, they really were fantasies, right? These were not gritty, realistic shows. Not even gritty is not even the point, but like, these were not, you didn't watch those shows and go like, I really relate to these characters. They were just like surface level jokes, and kind of, I call them bubblegum sitcoms. You know, they're just sort of like pass over you. You enjoy it. You forget it the minute you turn it off. It's pleasant, and then it's over. They really wanted to do something more substantive, and Grant thought that that was going to be something that really changed television, and he was right.
One of the big obstacles early on was their idea that Mary's character would be divorced. That didn't play well with the brass at CBS.
Right. So that is immediately, you see, it's like, and the problem with hiring these guys was that they were going to insist on, you know, I think that the network, when they hired Mary, thought she was going to kind of do the same thing, like maybe a combo of the Dick Van Dyke Show and I Love Lucy, right? Like, she'd be playing a pleasant housewife, but she'd be the star this time, you know? And instead, they came in with this crazy idea that she should be a woman, you know, coming out of a divorce and going out on her own, because they felt like this is something a lot of people are dealing with right now. It was 1969 when they pitched this. And when they pitched it, it did not go well at all, kind of famously. And, you know, it's funny the things people would say out loud at that time, you know, like, according to many accounts, including like the I talked to asked some of the executives that who had been in the, they were like, yeah, that's what we said, you know. They felt like, you know, divorced women at that time, one of them said, I felt like a divorced woman was kind of a loose woman, you know, used goods. And there was this idea that maybe audiences would be upset because they'd think that she had divorced Dick Van Dyke, which I love the way that they used to think about their audiences. You know what I mean? Like, how dumb do you think? Like, they think that their audiences are some other species of person that's much dumber than themselves, which explains a lot. But didn't have a lot of faith in audiences at the time. But, you know, they really just didn't want to do it. They didn't want to sully her reputation. They were scared. She had this very sort of good girl reputation. And one of my favorite things is that they called on the, like, you know, research guy at some point and said, and the research guy said, the things that people don't want to see in leads of network television shows are people with mustaches, people who are divorced, Jews, and New Yorkers. And it always makes me want to, there's probably a show out there that has literally that as their lead. It always makes me want to make that show. And I think it's also funny that the Mary Tyler Moore Show goes on to address actually basically all those things, except I'm sure there was somebody with a mustache. They weren't really big on mustaches. So other than that, they end up having, you know, the spinoff of Rhoda that is a Jewish character. Rhoda gets divorced. Mr. Grant gets divorced. You know, they snuck it in eventually.
Eventually, they decided to have her be single, coming out of a bad relationship. And then it became time to get the show going, shoot a pilot, and prepare for all of that. And I love the story you share in your wonderful book about the creation of the opening sequence that's become so iconic. We talked to Sonny Curtis last week, and he shared the story of recording the song. But was it Reza Bedoy, did I get that right, who had created those great openings for Get Smart and Hawaii Five-0 that they brought in?
Yeah. And I love, you know, I've been talking about this recently because I'm teaching a class on sitcom history online, and I've been really thinking about opening sequences. And, like, this is the golden age, right, of that. This was when you really did it up. People weren't going to change the channel on you. They were there to watch the show, and this would establish the mood of the show, and this really does it. You know, it actually has a classic, you know, thing that goes back to that, some of those 60s shows, like Gilligan's Island in particular. It is telling you the story of the show, right? It is telling you the setup, that she's on her own, will she make it, blah, 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 in the song, and the song is incredible. And then it kind of has this modern bent, too, where they went to Minneapolis, shot a bunch of stuff on location, which really grounds the show. It does make you actually kind of believe it's in Minneapolis when they definitely shot in Los Angeles, because they've got snow, they've got her by the lake, they've got her running around in her mini skirts and boots going shopping. And of course, the big final moment when they had her throw her hat in the air. I believe the idea was kind of like, the inspiration was, it's sort of like graduation, you know, how you throw your cap in the air if you have a graduation.
Right.
And she had this beret on, and they were like, why don't you try it? I think any iconic moment, it's very rare that someone says, like, I'm setting out to make an iconic moment, here we go. And this is no different. It was just like a good splash of inspiration. And another thing was that they talked about how they realized they had to freeze it in the air, like it's up in the air, her hat's up in the air, and they have to freeze it because it's like very sad if you just let it plop back down on the ground again. Like, then you're just, no, this isn't it. So yeah, this becomes this unbelievably iconic moment. I mean, you can still, it's possible that there are kids now who would understand this image but who have never seen the show. You know, it became the shorthand for a woman free and on her own, she's throwing her hat in the air, you know? I think lots of people have done that when they've moved to, like, New York to be on their own or whatever. It's just become this symbol that's even bigger than itself.
We're talking with Jennifer Cation Armstrong, author of Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted. The story of the casting of the show is very interesting as well. Ted Baxter is so perfect in the role of Ted Knight so perfect in the role of Ted Baxter, and yet they were looking originally for maybe somebody like a Lyle Waggoner, and even what gave three readings to John Aniston.
I know, I love it's one of my, I grew up watching Days of Our Lives, on which he made his life's work after this. So I, and also of course Jennifer Aniston's dad.
Right now, he was Stefano DiMera? Was that him?
No. I can't think of his name. He was another guy who was like also rich and also a little evil, but slightly less evil. That's what I remember. And he did have a mustache. So there you go. Very handsome man. And yeah, they were going for more. And one of my favorite details of this is the magic of casting to some extent, because people go in with an idea, but then they see something even better and they make the character around that, because their original idea, if this kind of makes you cringe too, was actually that that character would possibly be a love interest for Mary. I shudder to think about so many different ways that would be terrible for the show. But, you know, you can understand the instinct at the time. That's a normal thing to do in a sitcom cast, is have kind of a, like, maybe will they, won't they. And so they were looking for a more, like, handsome, young, I'm not saying Ted Knight wasn't handsome, but, you know, like, this, a type that Mary would go for. And they ended up instead seeing Ted Knight and just loving him so much that they built that character around him instead. And he was so good that it was like became a problem for him to prove to people later. You know, he felt it because he was worried people were going to think he was as dumb as his character. It was, he was so good though.
And I love the story you tell about him maybe sealing the deal by stopping at a thrift store on the way to his audition.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He decided to do the classic, like, dress and character moment. That really does work. You know, I think seeing the and it probably helps with acting. I'm not an actor, but I can see how it even helps with acting. Like, you're wearing this thing that isn't you and you're being this guy. And he's so funny. Like, that's the thing. He's just so, there's something special going on there. Like, there's something about playing a sort of dumb character, right? A dim-witted character, a vain character, that I always think it takes the best actors to do that and make it good and not make you hate the character, because you really love him. You feel for him. You're rooting for him despite it all.
Jack Klugman was the guy they really wanted to play the part of Lou Grant, but he had just signed a deal to do The Odd Couple, and so they brought in Ed Asner, but it didn't go very well during his first reading.
Yeah, this is another one that was really kind of like contentious behind the scenes, you know, because especially when you're dealing with network executives, the network executives just heard this and went like, no, we hate this idea. Ed was such a good dramatic actor and was known, of course, and continue, you know, like afterwards he did this a lot too. He would often play with what he called heavies, you know, like kind of a, like a, an evil character, conniving character. And there was concern about him being funny, you know, and I think he plays this character with such conviction that that's what makes him funny. He's never doing joke. Like, right. He's not telling hilarious, you know, he's not trying to be a comedian. The part of what's funny about him is he has such conviction in this role as this, like, guy who thinks he's this model of masculinity, but often, you know, has his own foibles. And that's what's sort of touching and sweet and funny about this character. I mean, when we eventually get to You've Got Spunk, right, in the pilot, that's why that's a funny moment, because he delivers it with such, I don't know, menace is a little strong a word. But, you know, like, it's the strength of the delivery that makes it.
Valerie Harper was certainly, as you point out, not what they had in mind for the character of Rhoda.
It's really funny when you're saying them one by one, I realize almost every one of these characters is like, this is not what they had in mind, but they were smart enough to go with the sort of alchemy of, oh, this is a great person. We're going to write toward this person instead. Yeah, this is another one. And it's such a strange time to some extent too, because it's like at that time they really felt like, okay, we need her to have a sidekick, a best friend, whatever you want to call it. But in, like, they felt like it was a rule that she had to be, as they said, schlubby, because Mary gets to be the pretty one, right? Couldn't possibly have two pretty girls in one scene, which is kind of odd. You'd think they'd want all of the pretty girls. But yeah, the idea was she was not supposed to outshine Mary in the beauty and glamour department. And, you know, Valerie is gorgeous. So, you know, that was going to be a problem. But, and at first they actually tried, if you watch the early episodes, you can see that they actually try to like dress her down. She's in, you know, baggy gray sweatshirts and stuff. Eventually they just give up and let her be super glamorous and it works out great. But that was a concern for them. But they saw that, first of all, she's a really funny actress and she had been doing like improv and stuff on the road. So she's, you know, she's like very quick, which is great. And they also, I think, saw the chemistry between her and Mary. These are, you know, they were really friends in real life. They had a lot of differences, just like their characters, but they were friends like that too. And I think they really saw that kind of spark going on between the two of them, which was super important. I mean, think of like, this is an iconic pairing. Ultimately, this is, you know, people would used to say like, are you the Mary or are you the Rhoda in your friendship, you know? And this became one of the big iconic sitcom friendships of all time.
A fascinating story about the taping of the pilot episode. The air conditioning went out. It was hot in the studio. Things didn't go well. The audience didn't react. Ed Asner was perhaps a bit too intense in the delivery of that line. And interestingly enough, it was the youngest cast member who maybe bailed them out. Little Lisa Gerritsen with her response to Rhoda. When they tweaked that, it seemed to make all the difference.
Yeah, I love this story. And it's like one of those things you can never truly know if that was the thing or if it was just like a bad day and a good day. But they really talked about it. As you said, it went terribly with this live audience in a test run. And they like Mary cried because she was like, my show, everyone hates my show. My show's going down. Grant called the producers and just said, it was like one of the few times he was sort of gruff and he just said, fix it. and they were like, oh. So they stayed up all night trying to figure it out and eventually just decided to make only one change, which was that Beth, Phyllis's daughter, who's about like 10, 11, 12 in there, says, so one of the problems was, we have to say that people did not like Rhoda. Rhoda was scary to them. She was coming on too strong. If you remember in the pilot, she is trying to get the same apartment that Mary wants.
Right.
And so she's being a little New York about it. You know, she's like basically planted herself there already. She tells Mary she's going to get it and she better just give up and go somewhere else. And so people didn't like somebody being mean to Mary. They felt very protective. And so the fix was for this little girl to say, you know, something along the lines of, you know, don't worry about Aunt Rhoda. She's really fun or something like that. So basically the idea was if the little girl expresses that she likes Rhoda and even, you know, more clever in one line kind of acknowledges, yes, she's comes on strong, but don't worry, you'll love her. That seems to have made a lot of difference. I do know, like, Ed also told me he felt like he tried to dial it down like two notches the next time he did I Hate Spunk, because he had maybe scared. That was another character who kind of scared the audience. So it seems like, you know, they all made their own little micro adjustments. And obviously it went, you know, it was not a gigantic success out of the gate, but it went over well enough that, you know, they were able to make their initial episodes and really prove themselves. And by, you know, eventually continued to get picked up, obviously, for seven seasons.
Well, and there was no guarantee, as you mentioned, that it would get past the initial 13-episode order. But really, Fred Silverman comes in across as one of the heroes of the story for believing in it, but also being willing to move it out of a pretty dead slot on Tuesday night to Saturday night, even before it premiered.
Yeah, this was, I mean, so Fred Silverman came in and took over at CBS. Like, he was a new guy, and This was a big deal in TV history because, kind of related to what I was saying before about the 60s shows, he enacted, and it's really hard to say when you say it out loud, what they called the Rural Purge. And this was all these shows like Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres. And there's this idea that there were all these shows that were kind of rural-ish.
And what was the Pat Buttram line? They canceled everything with a tree?
canceled everything with a tree because there was clearly at the time a different, you know, there are trends. And I think that that time they were really trying to court, you know, maybe the South and the Midwest. And then honestly, part of this is dollar based because they got more sophisticated about how they measured audiences and, like, you know, would get into more socioeconomic specifics at this time. And advertisers started to say that they really wanted wealthy, professional, young, usually urban audiences. And so, you know, Fred decided to sort of bring in, you know, build up this show as well as add in things like the Norman Lear shows, All in the Family and whatnot, and really made the extraordinary decision. Like, no one was sure Saturday night was even going to work. It was just that he did want to get it out of, you know, the Tuesday slot that wasn't working. But he, you know, no one was absolutely sure the Saturday thing was going to work, especially for the exact audience that they were saying they wanted, right? That those should be people who go out on Saturday nights. And when they ended up putting together this incredible lineup that, you know, eventually includes All in the Family and the Bob Newhart show. And that, you know, so they start to kind of figure out this is what people like. And it became this legendary lineup. And people would stay home on purpose to watch these shows. And it was like a cool sign that you were going to stay home and watch these shows. But it was all kind of, it was a big upheaval and it was pretty experimental at the time, but it ends up changing television in a lot of different ways.
Well, I thought it was very interesting too. It was a competition in many ways, but also it raised the bar for everybody when All in the Family came on the air and the writers, the producers talked with you in the book about how they would watch All in the Family. And even though it was a very different type of show, they realized they had to step up their game to be at that level.
Yeah, and I thought it was funny. They talked about there's one episode, and you can feel it if you watch it. There's an episode called Some of My Best Friends Are Rhoda, where they do address Rhoda's Jewishness, so that's kind of exciting because it was a little bit of a coy game before. But the episode is basically like, you know, Mary makes new friends, and the friend belongs to this country club, and it turns out Rhoda can't go with them because she's Jewish. And it's a very sort of, you see how that's very kind of All in the Family-ish. It's an issue. It's like one issue. Let's discuss it. And it's not their best work. And they knew that too afterwards. And they were like, oh, we need to not try to be All in the Family. You know, we need to just stick to what we do. And they do address issues, but in a very different way. It's a very character-based show. And so the way that they end up doing things, perhaps my actual favorite example of this is that there is a scene where Mary is going to have dinner with her father. He has come over for dinner. She's trying to have a better relationship with him. And so the mom brings dad over, and then mom is leaving the apartment to leave them to their father-daughter time. Yeah. And mom says, don't forget to take your pill. And both Mary and the dad say, I won't. And there's like a quick pause. But that's all, like, they never talk about it again. And what's funny is I don't even know if kids now watching, I don't know if they'd get it. I don't know if they would understand what happened. But the idea is that they're telling us that Mary's on birth control pills. And that was pretty new at the time. And it was pretty modern. It was pretty, like, out there because it also does a bunch of stuff, right? It also tells us Mary probably is having sex. You know, which was not something, there's another time right around the same time that they do explicitly address that, but like it's rare on the show. It's not Sex and the City, you know, so we can, they usually let us draw our own conclusions about her life. But, you know, if All in the Family did a birth control pill episode, you'd know it. It would be the birth control pill episode, you know, and there would be 22 minutes of arguing about whether it's okay to take birth control. Whereas this was like, their idea was kind of, let's show people they love Mary by now. Let's show them that, you know, the girl they love, who is very responsible and respectable, is on the pill, and that's okay. You know, that was sort of the idea. And also just as a character trait, like this is a modern woman living on her own. She has been without a significant other for several years now. Yes, she is going on dates and probably sleeping with some of them.
We're talking with Jennifer Cation Armstrong. Well, one of the things that makes the Mary Tyler Moore Show such a revolutionary and important show in TV history is the role of women on the writing staff. And can you talk about the contributions of people like Treva Silverman, Susan Silver, and Pat Nardo, who began as the secretary for Alan Burns and Jim Brooks?
Yeah, I mean, this was really my inspiration for writing this book, was when I found this out. But it all goes back to what we were talking about with Jim and Alan's kind of approach, which is that they really wanted things to feel real, and they wanted things to feel like of its time, you know? And they knew that if they were making a show about a single woman in the 1970s, that they had a problem because they were not single women in the 1970s. They were married men. So they needed to get some single women to contribute. And I think that's great because we're only just getting to this point now with some shows, right? That we've realized women should be in the room while women characters are being written. Black people should be in the room when black characters are being written, et cetera. And so they were really smart and also really progressive because they then realized there were very few women who were experienced in writing television comedies because there's no pipeline. No one had let them do it yet. So they didn't just say, okay, we give up. They really sought out and mentored women who could do this. So Treva was an exception. She had been one of the few out there already writing for shows. She had written for The Monkees and Love American Style and stuff like that. So she was an easy one. They knew her. They hired her from the beginning. She is brilliant. She's so good. But the others, you know, they would take women who are a little less experienced in writing for television and kind of, you know, mentor them along. So somebody like Pat Nardo is a great example. Their secretary was there typing their scripts, and she would often suggest better jokes than what they had. And they said, why don't you do this? So she did, you know, and this was, I think, again, this is something that people could still learn from today. A lot of times we say like, well, nobody, you know, no people of color applied or no women applied. I guess we don't have any. You can seek them out and you can help mentor people who don't have as much experience, you know, and that was what they did. And these women, you know, a lot of my book is stories from these women saying like, here's the story that happened in my life, and here's how we turned it into an episode of the show.
One of the great examples is the episode about the bridesmaid's dress, and both Burns and Brooks said, yeah, we never would have thought of that.
Yeah, I love that story because I think that's Susan who said, she said, you know, they thought I was brilliant because I just came in and told a story that happened to me in my life. And I think this is also so telling about, you know, the telling of other people's stories besides white straight men, right? Because white straight men are like, that's amazing. I can't believe that happened. And it's just normal to the woman who's telling it. And because it is funny, it's just that it hadn't been told a million times on television already or in movies before. And so everything felt fresh because it was like, oh, this is incredible. I didn't know this went on. Things like having to deal with bridesmaid dresses or, I feel like there's a number of fashion issues that come up. There's lots of stuff, you know, just date stories from the female perspective.
And stories about women's friendship, too. That's one of the things that the show was mm-hmm. so ahead of its time in dealing with friends. There's one great entire episode when Mary and Rhoda aren't speaking to each other.
Yes. I feel like that's another, that's such a, like, you can tell that it comes from female writers. Like, you can tell when you are a woman, you can tell when things were written by, I mean, yeah, I'm not saying no man can ever write about women, but you know what I mean? Like, you can often tell like, oh, this happened to somebody. And I also wonder if men would even, you know, I don't even know if they would pitch that story, right? Because they would almost be scared to pitch that kind of story. Whereas this is very real. It feels real. And it feels so emotional to us because Mary and Rhoda are such a good friend couple, when they're in a fight, it's just like terrifying, you know, like it's very stressful. And this is something I would also say the show did really well in general, which is emotion. That is something that was definitely absent from like those 60s comedies that I was talking about. They really were great at very easy toggling between, you know, funny and serious and making you cry and making you laugh. It doesn't feel like this forced thing. It just happens because it's such good writing.
One of my favorite stories about the show, because it says so much about the creators of the show, but also that it was a different time 50 some years ago, mm-hmm. is the story of a young man. I hope I get his name right. Is it Joe Rainone?
Yes, Joe Rainone is my favorite. He was such a find for me in my research. So as I was going along talking to people, it's funny because he kept coming up. So he's a fan of the show. That's it. And it just was bizarre to me that multiple times, unprompted, the producers or writers would be like, yeah, there was this guy. What, you know, one or two of them actually remembered his full name. And it's such a distinctive name, you know, that I became pretty obsessed with. I was like, this guy's got to be out there, right? So the thing was that this guy would write them long, multiple-page letters every week where he would, I mean, it's a very, like, I always say he was a proto-blogger, right? Because would have thought to do this then? It was not done. People didn't think about TV this way usually then. But he would write these multiple-page letters in which, yes, he was saying he was fan, and he was doing it out of love, but he would analyze the whole show, the whole episode. He'd tell them everything he liked, everything he didn't like. He'd give it a rating at the end. I mean, I just can't get over the sort of, like, chutzpah of this to some extent, but I know he also, I don't really think he expected, you know, them to necessarily respond. He was just like, I just wanted to tell them what I thought, and this is, you know, and he's this kind of person, he thinks this way. And they really started to, like, because it was not something that most people did, you know, they actually kind of started to be like, God, they would wait and see what his letter said, and, like, see what the rating was this week. And eventually, also, I think it speaks to their generosity, you know, and openness. Yeah. That eventually they would send him a birthday card. They invited him to the set, and he went, and it was like one of the greatest weeks of his life. He got to sit in on meetings. He took a bunch of pictures that are in my book. He went to the finale. He was in touch with them for a while. It just was such a... I loved that story. I love fan stories. I'm not going to lie. I'm a sucker for them. But I thought, especially this at that time, like, now we're very used to this idea, right? Because we have access to our favorites online pretty easily, and everybody has an opinion and everybody shares it online. This was not done then. No one, there wasn't even a you know, newspaper columnist who was going to be recapping the show every single week, you know? And this guy was paying so much attention that I think they, and was polite and nice and everything else. And so I think that really hit them, that, like, God, this guy really cares about our show at this level. And he was also such, for me, then I did eventually find him. I'm still friends with him. I've recently exchanged emails with him. He sends me Christmas cards and birthday cards every year. He's so great. He's in Rhode Island and he's really lovely. And, I just thought, like, it's so interesting. He was this sort of proto fan nerd and was such a nice entry point into the show to me, like, to show what it felt like to watch it from the outside. And, you know, isn't even maybe necessarily what we think of now as a Mary Tyler Moore Show fan. Like, we think now more of, like, shows as male or female or this or that. But everybody watched it at the time, even young men. And he said he had a crush on Mary, you know. It's just, like, I loved that whole, his whole odyssey there. And it really speaks to them, too, that they were so open to him.
So, Jennifer, what is it today, 50 years later, some 42, 43 years after the show went off the air? It holds up so very well. It remains among, I think, the greatest sitcoms in the history of American television. Why does it still work? Why is it so funny? And what's the key to its lasting success?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I wrote something for BuzzFeed, actually, not that long ago, imploring the Youngs to watch the show on Hulu if they have not, because it really holds up. It's honestly shocking to me that it holds up so well. And I think that it's because it was so character-based, because it was so character-driven. It is a reflection of its time, which I think makes it interesting to watch and fun. I almost feel like it's so well done. It's like you could just tell someone that this is a period piece about the 1970s that was made today. You know what I mean? Like Mad Men or something. And you would sort of believe it. And it's because it really stays with its characters and it stays true to them and it tells their stories. And that's it. So it doesn't do this, like, it's not ripped from the headlines. It's not, and this is not, you know, I think All in the Family holds up in a different way as a time capsule, but like, I think this really is so watchable and so relatable because honestly, we don't solve most human problems. You know what I mean? Like a lot of the stuff is still the same, even as technology and fashion changes. Right. So, you know, it's still weird to go out on dates, and it's still hard. Unfortunately, it's still almost equally as hard for women in the workplace, a little bit better, but you know, it's still like all of these things are still true. And female friendship is still about the same, you know, and the fashion is tremendous on this show. It's so, so glamorous and cool and 70s. So I just feel like I really, and something that has come up recently is a lot of more recent old shows, if you know what I mean, like Friends, you know, people are rewatching them and going like, why are there so many anti-gay jokes or whatever? This show doesn't do that. No. This show doesn't, like, it's not problematic. It's crazy. It's not very diverse, but other than that, it's like very unproblematic to modern ears, which is rare. So it also speaks to sort of, I think, the sort of high class level of their writing and production and everything else.
Jennifer, thanks so much. Great to have you back on with us again.
Thank you.